Okay, so let me continue and do the second part of the presentation. And I'm actually really grateful I was given this opportunity to talk about another paper, which is related. In this paper, we're looking at risk and return of a number of fixed income arbitrage strategies. And this is a joint paper with Jefferson Duarte and Francis Longstaff. So the motivation for this paper is that that fixed income arbitrage is a broad set of market neutral investment strategies, and this is capital structure arbitrage. Of course, is a hybrid strategy which exploits differences between equity and debt, and there are a number of other fixed income strategies that that are broadly called fixed income arbitrage. Now, we know that in 1998, there was this hedge fund crisis, and the central player in that crisis was LTCM. Now, after that, there were a number of years where people didn't think of that highly of fixed income arbitrage. But if you look at this picture shows the total amount of capital devoted to fixed income arbitrage over the last decade. Actually, you see that there's a drop after 1998. But then in recent years, especially in the last 2 or 3 years, it has gone up significantly over time. So it's gone from $2 billion 10 years ago to something like $48 billion as we speak. So it is a growing sector of the hedge fund industry. So in terms of the open issues, one might think about looking at these strategies. First of all, is fixed income arbitrage truly arbitrage, or is it just, again, back to the same sort of questions I posed for capital structure arbitrage, is it just taking risk? And so in particular, there was a story about an exchange between Merton Miller, a Nobel Prize winning economist from the University of Chicago, and Myron Scholes, who was behind LTCM. So Miller was asking Scholes, what were you guys doing at LTCM, and to which Myron Scholes responded that we were just like a gigantic vacuum machine sucking up nickels from all across the world. So then you might wonder, well, you know, is it a strategy that generates small positive returns most of the time, but occasionally has a huge crash like LTCM did experienced in 1998? Is this something that can be broadly observed for fixed income arbitrage strategies in general? Or perhaps the large losses during the hedge fund crisis is simply because of excess leverage. And we know LTCM put on a leverage of 30 to 1. Is it just because of leverage, or is it because some deeper reasons due to the inherent nature of these strategies? And also we might think about, is there a link between hedge fund returns and the amount of capital devoted to hedge fund to fixed income arbitrage? That one might intuitively think that the more capital you devote to a strategy, the returns will tend to decline. Do we see that in empirical data? So that's something that we might worry about. So the list of strategies that we look at in this paper are five, and we think that these are fairly popular strategies. The first one is called, I'll explain every one of those later on. We look at swap spread arbitrage, yield curve arbitrage, and we also look at mortgage arbitrage, fixed income volatility arbitrage, and the last one I won't spend so much time on because we just talked about it, is capital structure arbitrage. So the methodology is similar to Mitchell and Palvino, and we explained how we actually did this. It's very similar to the capital structure arbitrage that we just went through. The advantages of this, so before this paper, people were looking at hedge fund returns, and they were just looking at returns reported by hedge funds. Of course, we know that hedge funds actually, not all hedge funds report these returns, so there is a huge backfill bias or survivorship bias that only the ones that have done very well tend to report these returns. So those ones that are not doing very well, they die and they don't report their returns. So if you use these reported returns as empirical analysis, you might suffer for these survivorship bias problems. But if you compute these returns from bottom up, if you build these returns yourself, you don't suffer that same problem. And also, we can actually look at a much longer period of time would be possible using reported data. So those are why we picked this particular approach. Also, the effects of leverage can be held fixed. So the way that we do this is we fixed the annualized volatility at 10% per year. And then we look at the average return for the strategy. So we fixed the leverage. If you look at the reported data from hedge funds, you don't really know what they're doing, what kind of leverage each hedge fund is putting on. So that tends to be very, very hard to interpret. So the first strategy is the swap spread arbitrage. And this strategy is the following, that the trader enters into a swap, an interest rate swap, receives fixed and pays floating LIBOR rate. And he also shorts a treasury bond with the same maturity as the swap, paying out the coupon rate, the constant maturity treasury rate, and then invests the proceeds in a repo account, earning the repo rate. So basically, the swap spread arbitrage is a simple bet on the differences between two rates. The one is the swap spread, which is the constant maturity swap minus the constant maturity treasury yield. So that's the swap spread, and that one is fixed the moment you enter into a swap. Now, the other side is the floating spread, which is the LIBOR minus the repo, and that is a floating rate. So basically, the strategy is you're betting that the fixed swap spread is bigger than the floating rate, which changes over time as you enter into the strategy. Now, this number actually is fairly stable, and it's mostly positive. But occasionally, short spread, the floating spread, can become very big if the LIBOR increases dramatically. Now, if you think about the risk inherent in the LIBOR, LIBOR is reported by a consortium of banks, international banks in London. So if the LIBOR rate increases, that means the whole financial sector is suffering problems. So it is a systemic or a systematic risk. Now, so that's the basic intuition of the swap spread arbitrage. Now, we implemented this using swap, treasury, and repo data from November 1988 to December 2004. So what we did was we fit an OU process to the floating spread, ST, so we fit it. And based on this fitted process, for each month, we can calculate an expected average value of the spread for the horizon, for the duration of the strategy. So if we put on a two-year swap, it would be the average of this floating rate for 2 years, in other words. Okay. Now, we enter a trade if this difference exceeds 10 or 20 basis points, and we close out the trade when this difference disappears. So this is a picture of this. This is the black line. The solid black line is the swap spread. Okay. And this thinner line represents the expected value of the floating spread over the life of that trade. It could be 2 years, it could be 3 years, it could be 5 years or 10 years. Okay? So basically what happens is if this level reaches a certain point, say 10 basis points, you would enter into the strategy. Okay? You would go long interest rate swap, receive fixed and play floating, and then you short the treasury. And then you do this and you hold on to the positions until either the swap is maturing, the two-year swap has run out of its life for 2 years, or the two time series have converged to each other. So this is the essence of this particular swap spread trading. Now, we also construct the index return very similar to what I explained just now. So every month it could be multiple trades put on at different points in the past, and you can calculate some kind of equally weighted average return across all these trades and call that an index return. Okay? And based on this index return, then you can look at the systematic risk in this particular strategy. And also you can adjust the initial capital put into this strategy so that you can achieve an annualized volatility of 10%. So this is the sense in which you can equalize the leverage across different strategies. Okay, now I don't think you can read this. It's too small. But basically what we have here is that there are some key findings here. First of all, that all of the returns here, most of the returns are positively skewed. Okay, so there's a skewness to the right-hand side, and the mean is higher than the median. Oh, can you make it bigger?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Good,
right.
Good.
So that's good enough. And also, I mean, there's also excess kurtosis. So this is, it's got more kurtosis, more fatter tails than a normal distribution, and it's positively skewed. Okay. And the sharp ratio here, and the serial correlation is not significant, so it's not really doesn't really have autocorrelation in the returns. And the sharp ratio is between 0.3 and 0.7. Again, very similar to the ones that we've seen with capital structure arbitrage, and also across these hedge fund index returns. So so this is one strategy that we're looking at. Okay, and also one thing that might be interesting is the level of capital that's required to achieve a 10% annualized volatility is about, in this case, it's $3 for $100 notional of the interest rate swap. So the required capital is pretty low. It's fairly small. And this level actually increases when the maturity of the swap is increasing, and I think this is because of the duration issue. It's more sensitive to interest rate risk, so, and that's why the this really depends on the accuracy of the hedging. In other words, you're using the treasury to hedge the interest rate swap. The more duration you have, the more sensitive you are to interest rate risk, and therefore, the more risk you have, the more capital you would need to achieve the same level of standard deviation. Now, the next strategy that we look at, it's okay. Take care of this. Yeah, it's okay. The next strategy we look at is called yield curve arbitrage. So the intuition for this is you're doing some type of analysis for the term structure of swap yields, swap rates, and you apply this analysis to identify points along the yield curve that are either rich or cheap, and you just buy low and you sell high. Now, the investor enters into a portfolio to exploit this perceived mispricing. And so he does this by going long and short bonds in a way that minimizes the risk of the portfolio. Okay? And the way that we do this is the following. So first of all, we fit a two-factor Vasicek model to the swap curve every month. Okay? And we do this by, it's a two-factor model, affine model, and so we can fit the model exactly by matching exactly the one-year yield and the 10-year yield. So we're just fitting, fitting the two ends of the term structure, 1 and 10. And then we look at other maturities, and we see how far off the fitted curve is from the other swap rates. Okay? So for example, suppose you're looking at the 2-year swap rate, and if the 2-year swap rate is more than 5 or 10 basis points than the above the fitted 2-year swap rate, then you would enter into a trade. You receive fixed on $100 notional of a 2-year swap, and then you short 1-year and 10-year swaps in a way so that there are no sensitivities to the two affine factors. So in other words, if you're just using this model, then you're completely hedged. Okay? Now, and this is called a butterfly trade because you're going long the 2-year and you're going short the 1-year and the 10-year. It's like a butterfly position. So once this trade was put on, it would be held for either a year or until the market 2-year swap rate converges to the model value. So here's another picture. This is a 2-year, 3-year, 5-year, and 7-year. So this is the difference between the market swap rate and the fitted swap rate. So you would see that if this number deviates from zero, if it's a sufficient level away from zero, you can enter into a position and you hold it until that number gets back to zero. So that's the essence of this particular transaction. Now, so make this larger a little bit. So again, you can look at the same sort of thing, and we'll look at this for all five of these strategies. And in this case, you see a lot of the median returns are zero because in a lot of the different months in the sample period, you don't put on the trade. The gap is simply not big enough. So that explains why a lot of the median values are zero. Now, the skewness is also positive, so you get positive skewness and excess kurtosis here. No serial correlation. The sharp ratio is also in that range. Now, let me just explain the skewness issue a little bit. If you think about the returns as picking up nickels in front of a steamroller, that means you're picking up small returns most of the time, and then occasionally you get burned. That means the skewness ought to be negative, right? you have large negative returns sometimes, mostly small positive returns, that should be a negative skewness. But we don't see negative skewnesses for these two strategies. We see positive skewness. So that means the common wisdom of picking up nickels in front of a steamroller doesn't really apply for these two fixed income arbitrage strategies. Now, now let me move on to the third one. We also look at what's called mortgage arbitrage, and the intuition is that you're always buying these mortgage-backed securities. The very simplest ones are the pass-throughs, so essentially all of the cash flows from the underlying pool is passed on to investors. Now, you can hedge the interest rate exposure using interest rate swaps. In this case, we're hedging with five-year interest rate swaps. Okay. Now, the long positions in the pass-throughs are financed with a type of repurchase agreements, which are called a dollar roll. It's very similar to a repurchase agreement using treasury securities. Now, the fact that this type of mortgage pass-through securities, they have prepayment risk. Okay, so when interest rates are low, investors can the mortgage holders can refinance. So that makes sure that there is an upper bound for the price. You can never go beyond that. So that actually creates a negative convexity. Okay, and so here is the negative convexity. You have a concavity relationship. So this is a fitted relationship between the five-year swap rate and the pass-through price. Okay, so there's a cap here. That's because of the prepayment option. And this creates this kind of a concave relationship. Now, this is a non-parametrically fit curve. So it's not due to a model. It's an empirically fit relationship. Now, once you have this relationship, you can compute a hedge ratio. So you can delta hedge this relative to the interest rate swap rate. And this is the value of a hedged portfolio when the swap rate was 6% to start with. So what you see here is this actually inherits the negative convexity here. So once you have a large interest rate movement in either direction, you can lose money. And investors will demand extra spreads for taking on this sort of negative convexity risk. Okay. So what we do is we use Ginnie Mae pass-throughs with coupons closest to the current coupon rate, and we hedge this with five-year interest rate swaps for an extended period of time. Okay, and the hedge ratios are determined using non-parametrically fit the estimation, and so the hedge ratios are determined not using a prepayment model, but we're using non-parametric estimation. So that makes sure that the hedge ratio doesn't really depend on a particular model. Now, the positions are held as long as a discount pass-through remains a discount pass-through, or in other cases, we might have par pass-through or premium pass-throughs. They would differ in terms of this convexity number. Okay. Now, when we look at the risk and return of this strategy, what we find is fairly interesting. When you look at, we have three types of mortgage pass-throughs. They could be discount or par or premium. If you look at this type of the returns to the strategy, what you find is that the mean return for the discount and the par strategies are positive and significant, and the ones for the premium strategy is very close to zero. So you're not getting any returns on this. The reason for that for this one is if you have a premium pass-through, you're prone to prepayment risk. So the negative the concavity actually is very large. So it's very easy for you to actually lose money if interest rates change by a little bit. This might trigger a wave of prepayment. Okay, so that's what we observe from this. And also the skewness here is positive excess kurtosis. These two things appear to be the norm across these fixed income arbitrage strategies. And let me go to the last one that I will talk about. This is volatility, fixed income volatility arbitrage. And in this arbitrage, in the simplest form, this is usually implemented by selling options and then hedging the options with the exposure to the underlying asset. And this is fairly general. Now, theoretically, you can show, and we do this in the appendix of the paper, and it's actually, if anyone wants to get a copy of that paper, you can just send me an email and I can send you the paper. The excess return you can show theoretically that's proportional to the gamma of the option multiplied by the difference between the implied variance and the realized variance of the underlying asset. So you can also think of this as a swap. You're just swapping implied volatility with the realized volatility. Okay. Because of that, you can implement this either as sort of you can sell caps and floors. You can sell a straddle with basically zero delta. And or you can actually implement a portfolio of volatility swaps or variance swaps. Okay. Now, because of this, the strategy is essentially model independent because you don't really have a delta. The delta is almost is zero by construction. You're just selling a straddle here. Now, when we do the plot here, what you see is the implied variance. Oh, by the way, I forgot that we're doing this with interest rate caps. And we're hedging them with Eurodollar futures. Now, when you do that, you see that the implied variance is usually higher than the realized variance, but occasionally the realized variance can be much higher and it can actually exceed the implied variance. Okay. So if you look at the risk and return profile here, what you find is, in this case, it is a case of picking up nickels in front of a steamroller. In the sense that the skewness is negative, okay, and you have excess kurtosis, and the other aspects are similar to the other strategy. So this strategy appears to be the only one that really has a negative skewness, and all the other ones, including capital structure arbitrage, that I won't talk about because it's very similar, they all have positive skewness. Okay, so let me move on and skip over the cap arb. Now, systematic risk of the strategies. Now, these strategies are typically described as market neutral. However, that they if you look carefully at these strategies, all of them have residual exposure to the market risk factors. For example, the swap spread arbitrage, as I was mentioning, that it actually is sensitive to the default risk in LIBOR. So it has a sensitivity to the banking sector default risk. The yield curve arbitrage, you're neutralizing two term structure factors, but we know from empirical research that the term structure, default-free term structure, has at least three factors. So if you neutralize two factors, there's another factor that you're missing out. And so you might have exposure to another term structure factor. The mortgage arbitrage, you have, again, the risk of prepayment in there. And the volatility arbitrage, you might be picking up what's called the volatility risk premium. And this is a very hotly researched area right now in option pricing literature. And also the capital structure arbitrage, and we mentioned that this has some residual exposure to economy-wide default risk. So all of this, when you run a regression, what we try to control for, essentially, a large number of these systematic risk factors. We have equity risk, we have the Farmer-French market factors, small minus big, high minus low, and we have the momentum factors in there. We also have S&P bank stock index. This is for the banking sector. The bond market factors, we have the 2-year, 5-year, 10-year treasury excess returns in there. And for the credit market factor, we have industrial bonds and also bank sector bonds. We have all of those thrown in. So trying to control for systematic risk. We also use two hedge fund return indexes. We have the CSFB Tremont index and also the Hedge Fund Research Institute index. We also have that to just as a benchmark comparison. Now, when you run these regressions, there are a lot of regressors in there, and so I probably won't bother you with this. So let me just go to the interpretations. So we actually pick up quite a number of systematic risks, and some of them are, as we pointed out, like in this case, we do have exposures to a number of these banking sector stock or bond returns, and also for the capital structure arbitrage, if you look at the short side only, you do have exposures to, for example, the industrial bond return. You're sensitive to that, and you're also sensitive to small minus big, which people have shown that actually captures some type of default risk. So let me go on and look at the excess returns in hedge fund capital. So intuition suggests that as you have more capital devoted to fixed income arbitrage, you tend to drive out the returns. Now, that we don't know how much that level of capital will ought to be before that happens. So before that happens, actually, you might imagine a situation where increased capital actually amounts to better liquidity for the underlying assets. So it actually tends to help the convergence of this type of strategy. So it's not very clear that which direction that it will go. So it's really an empirical question. So when we regress the risk adjusted, so we take the prior regression and we look at the residuals from that regression. We take out all of the systematic risks and we look at the excess returns and regress that on the total amount of capital devoted to fixed income arbitrage. And what we find, again, is that we have different results for different strategies. So for some of the strategies, this comes out to be negative, and for some strategies, this comes out to be positive. Again, we don't really have strategy-specific amount of capital. So in other words, we have the total amount of capital devoted to quote-unquote fixed income arbitrage. We don't have a further breakdown in terms of different categories of fixed income arbitrage. And so that might actually hamper the interpretation of our results. But I think that is an interesting issue to explore, and we don't have as much data as we need to answer this question yet. So this is just preliminary exploration, if you will. So to summarize, a majority of the returns actually produce significant excess returns, and this is a raw excess returns. The Sharpe ratio lies between 0.3 and 0.9. This is on the same magnitude of these reported Sharpe ratios by hedge funds. Most of the monthly returns are positively skewed, so that means that the usual interpretation of picking up nickels in front of a steamroller doesn't really apply. We have fat tails in these distributions, so that tends to be the norm. There's no significant autocorrelation. The amount of capital required to obtain annualized volatility of 10% varies across strategies. It could be huge for capital structure arbitrage, and I think the reason there is because the hedge is very imperfect. If you look at something like the yield curve arbitrage, where you're using 1-year and 10-year bonds to hedge a 5-year swap, that the hedging there tends to work much better, and as a result, the required level of capital to achieve a 10% standard deviation is much less, much smaller. So that I think that's how you can interpret that number. Further summary, the returns on many of the strategies are sensitive to many of the systematic risk factors. It's something that's interesting, I don't know if you can read too much into this or not, that three of the strategies, that the yield curve, the mortgage arbitrage, and credit capital structure arbitrage, these are the strategies that actually require a model. These are the other strategies, like the swap spread arbitrage, doesn't really require a complex model, and the volatility arbitrage doesn't require a model either. It's just implemented as a volatility swap, right? So you're not computing hedge ratios or anything. So in those two cases, you don't have any excess returns after taking out the systematic risk factors. But for these three strategies, which require a complex model to compute hedge ratios to implement, you actually have excess returns, residual alphas, as they would call it, after adjusting for market risk. So I think that's something that's very interesting. We don't know how much you can read into this, but I think it's just an interesting result. Finally, the link between returns and capital is perhaps indicated by our results. It's probably more complex than a simple intuition would indicate. Okay, so that concludes it. Thank you.